Hello everyone, it's Bastille Day today, July 14th, 2023, the anniversary of the spark of the French Revolution in 1789 and the storming of the Bastille. And so it's fitting that today, which happens to be the 50th anniversary of my own entry into revolutionary politics, it's fitting that we reflect on this day and a memory of mine that I hope inspires you and elevates you in these trying times. It's called A Revolutionary Remembrance, My First Protest 50 Years Ago Today by yours truly, Kevin Annett, Eagle Strong Voice. It happened on Bastille Day, naturally. I was 17 and a raw recruit to radical politics, having sampled a bit of it at the local socialist hangout known as Vanguard Books in Vancouver. The flaming red poster on its window announced a big protest rally that same day against the latest U.S. nuclear testing that was radiating our West Coast. I was off to that protest like a bullet. The sound of the multitudes reached me before their numbers came into view, a wonderful sea of humanity stretching from the old Vancouver courthouse down Georgia Street as far as I could see. Thousands of voices exclaimed a common outrage as they swept me into their ranks. The downtown core shook with a new sound that drowned out banality and business as usual. "We can stop them," said that single voice. "We are many, and they are few." You know, in that instant, a joy I had never known before and that would last me a lifetime suddenly gripped me and raised me above myself to a new purpose. Here is where I belonged, in the struggle to change the world. To live only for myself seemed suddenly absurd and selfish. With surging delight, I worked my way through the crowd as friendly hands thrust leaflets at me and friendlier faces beamed and shared a common bliss. I was drawn to the heart of the protest on the courthouse steps, where speakers ranted and longhairs like me draped banners and themselves over the staid stones. And that's when I spotted the army cadets across the street. They were kids my age and even younger, and they formed what they called an honor guard for the lieutenant governor, who was scheduled to appear at the Hotel Vancouver right next to our rally. The guy's name was John Nicholson, and he had as much chance of getting past us into that posh hotel as a pig has to fly. Some of our people were grouped around the cadets, talking to them and pinning what turned out to be Greenpeace buttons onto their uniforms. Then an old man broke through the crowd and yelled at the kids, "You guys should all desert! That asshole Nicholson is a big wheel and brass can. That Canadian company that overthrew the Brazilian government in 1964 and it brought in the fucking military." We all cheered our support as the cadets looked vaguely embarrassed, and I handed leaflets to them, and they read them carefully. The old guy came up to me and said, "Reminds me of the Peg back in 1919. "Winnipeg," I replied. "Fucking A," he smiled, showing gaps. "We had the soldiers cornered in their barracks, and we told them to desert, and some of them did. They knew they were being used to bust our strike, and they didn't like it, so we put it to them." "You mean the Winnipeg General Strike?" I said. "You were there?" "Wasn't any older than you are now," he said. "Made me a goddamn radical for life, it did." A burly cop appeared in the besieged doorway of the hotel just then, and he stared with horror at our motley crowd as he said something into his walkie-talkie. My old buddy spotted him and spat out, "Fucking scabs in uniform, they never change." "Well, they can't do much harm to us right now," I replied, gesturing to our huge crowd. The guy slapped me on my arm with a laugh and a look that took decades off his face. "That's it, boys. Workers of the world unite, and we got the bastards by the balls." Well, somehow our colossus began to move towards the American consulate as our banners and bullhorns led the way, and some guys shimmying up lampposts with their placards. My old buddy vanished into the crowd, waving his arms and shouting, but something of him always remained with me. I couldn't get anywhere near to the consulate, but it didn't matter. There were plenty of other juicy targets along the way. A bunch of protesters burst into the Royal Bank and started leafleting the tellers, while a younger version of my buddy yelled at them with a bullhorn, "Royal Bank, blood money from Brazil! Occupy, nationalize, throw out the corporate bums!" Across Burrard Street was the Anglican church that 3 decades later I would help occupy, along with native survivors of Christian genocide, a slaughter of the innocents that was happening just a few miles away from where we marched on the North Shore, in the Squamish so-called residential schools. On those church steps, a woman was yelling something at us with a twisted look of hatred. It's a curious fact that even the most militant Canadians will stop for red lights during demonstrations, and our crowd was no exception. The riot police, who lingered on the margins of our action, used the break in our ranks to rush in and start arresting people. But once our people combined again, Vancouver's less than finest found themselves surrounded. Their thuggery dissolved in an instant in the face of our power. Apparently some top cop read the riot act to our people at the consulate, but nobody was worried. We knew that as long as we stuck together, nothing could touch us. And that lesson was not forgotten by me and by many of us on that radiant day. We'd be back again in even greater numbers over the years that followed. Indeed, we returned only 2 months later to the U.S. consulate, after 30,000 people like us in Chile had been butchered by a U.S.-sponsored military coup. That tragedy taught me that we cannot make our revolutions only halfway, any more than you can skin a tiger claw by claw. We always learn the best lessons the hard way, but we do so together or not at all. What passes for protest these days is like watching compliant psych ward patients line up for their medication. The irreverent outrage, the imagination, and the courage of my generation is nowhere to be seen. But our spirit persists nevertheless. I felt it the other day as I stood where our voices once filled the sky and I was baptized into my purpose. Take away our hands and our feet and even our lives, and that spirit will endure, as does the soul of every defeated revolutionary that finds its way into our hearts so that the vision can continue and take root again among us. I recently ran into one of my few remaining comrades from those early days. He gave me a happy smile when I reminded him of the mega protest on July 14, 1973, where we first met and took our step together into the revolutionary movement. Larry's aged eyes sparkled as we recalled that wondrous devotion and how it never left us, and he began to cry. He took my arm and said, "It never mattered if we won or lost, did it, Kev? What matters is that we tried and that we never gave up." During the American Civil War, our brother Walt Whitman put it this way: "Courage yet, my brother, my sister, keep on. Liberty is to be served whatever occurs, for nothing is quelled by failure or the indifference of the people, or by the show of power, soldiers, cannon, penal statutes. What we believe in waits forever through all the continents. What we believe in invites no one, promises nothing, sits in calmness and light, knows no discouragement, waiting patiently, waiting its time. Not songs of loyalty alone are these, but songs of insurrection. For I am the sworn poet of every dauntless rebel the world over, and he going with me leaves peace and routine behind him and stakes his life to be lost at every moment. Then courage yet, revolter, revoltress, for till all else ceases, you must not cease. For when liberty goes out of a place, it is always the last to go. When there are no more memories of heroes and martyrs, and when all life and the souls of men and women are discharged from any part of the earth, only then shall liberty be discharged too, and the tyrant enter into full possession. So carry on in revolt, and revolt again. Walk unheld, free, the whole earth over, till we make our ineffaceable mark upon time and peoples, and saturate all eras, that the men and women of races ages to come may prove brethren and lovers as we are." And this is Kevin Annett, age 17, right there with my fellow revolutionaries. Same year that protest happened. And so from both of us, we say, carry it on, friends. Carry on the revolution, within and without. This is Kevin Annett, Eagle Strong Voice, murderbydecree.com, republicofcanada.org. Stay tuned very soon for more. And the thing about Charles is that he, by very fact, sitting in that position, he is automatically guilty because the institution has been found guilty as a transnational genocidal system. It doesn't have any lawful legitimacy. The parliament dissolved the monarchy in March 1649. It made it a crime of treason to reestablish the monarchy. This has been, since 1649, that's been a banned, unlawful institution. So
that's the thing to focus on, not, you know, the foibles. As a matter of fact, they want us to focus on the individuals as if it's about bad apples. That's always the theory behind genocide. Oh, it was just some bad priests. Oh, we just had the wrong pope in or the wrong monarch in. Now it'll be different, right? I mean, that's the game they play all the time. But we know the nature of this beast, and you got to slay the beast and not just one of its tentacles, right?
Well, it's a loyalty and a hierarchy thing, right? So, you know, the further you go up to the summit, if you like, of the infrastructure of these hierarchies, whether you're talking Freemasonry, whether you're talking Satanism, whether you're talking about, you know, whatever the Knights of Malta or the black nobility of the Venetian cult, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, it all arrives at that singularity point of the top of the monarchy, the crown, right? So we have these individuals who, you know, individually you can pick holes at, just to say the least. You know, you can pull out evidence of what the individuals have done, but they were brought up specifically to be these inverted role models. You know, the truth of the matter is that the bigger the monster, the higher up the hierarchy they go, right? And they're trained to be those kind of monsters through these monarch mind control, childhood trauma-based torture operations.
I don't ultimately think that matters that much. I mean, it's not even a question of them, because of course we're always focused on them as if they matter. The question is always, why do people allow it to happen? And why, you know, we can throw them off like a flea off a dog if we just ignore them, take back, you know, reclaim the land, reclaim our identity, tell us out monarchs of all sorts, including the economic oligarchs who are running the planet. We could do it tomorrow if people were conscious and united. That's the thing we need to focus on. Every ounce of what we do has to be focused on breaking people away from that. But, you know, it's very hard in the internet culture, because any, you know, kind of sensational story can pose as fact. And so what if you know these things? Then what do? Does it arm people to change? Does it give you the strength and the confidence to do it? Most things I see about this never do. They just, it's like a rat chasing his tail. Oh yeah, the latest scandal, like who cares? I don't really care. We know the nature of these things. I know because they've destroyed my life, killed my friends, taken my children from me. I know you weren't awarded the death of this thing, and people have got to start taking responsibility. That's what I see lacking. People are not taking responsibility for ending this regime, right?
Well, this is the attempt. You use the word uniting the people, right? And that's what they're trying to do with the latest soap opera, you know, narrative. This one is a funeral. It's the idea is to unite the people under the flag, you know, underneath the crown or whatever. And because they have, as you just said as well, because they have control of the media channels in the way that they do, then, you know, even our conversation here on the internet is basically like, you know, Robin Hood having his meetings at the Sheriff of Nottingham's castle, right? You know, the whole thing is completely controlled in terms of the communication channels. And go for it.
That's the most first basic issue is you don't form an alternative by doing it through the internet, because it's, you know, GlaxoSmithKline controls Zoom and Google and YouTube. So the point is that when you get the alternative is when people meet locally, and we do that all the time in our Republic meetings, common law meetings. You get people together face to face and you say, what law are we going to pass in our community that's going to change things? Like keep the tax money in the community, seize these church and crown buildings. They can all be seized now legally. The warrants are all there in murderbydecree.com, right? And so... getting people to take that step, it takes the hard, consistent work on the ground, face-to-face in your own community. So, the many attempts on this, 95% of the attempts fail. Not because of infiltration, not because of mind control, because of the people themselves. It's like, you know, remember the Spartacus slave rebellion in 73 AD, I think it was, in Rome. Most of the slaves of Italy revolted. They almost overthrew the Roman system, okay, but the slaves didn't do it primarily. It was Spartacus, and there was a core leadership of gladiators. I don't know if you saw the movie with Kirk Douglas, but these gladiators broke free and they were the trained cadre that led everybody. He didn't go and speak to the slaves about, hey, we should revolt now, let's have a plan for how we revolt. They went ahead and started killing the slave owners, and they led the slaves in a revolt. They didn't talk, they acted. And that's something that people don't have the ability to. They've lost the ability to act. And that's the first thing we have to understand. We have to lead by example. That's why we occupy churches. We say, look, this is how you do it. Now let's do it. Action now is a measure of all things. And that's the only language I understand these days. And that's why it's hard to communicate with people, because they're expecting, okay, what do I need to read next? Right? No, it's not about reading. It's not about information. You know what the problem is, people, right?
Yeah. And so those actions, you know, the question then, what are the actions? Well, you can get together in, you know, the town hall or the church hall or whatever it is, and you can get together, but then it's another talking shop, right? So, you know, in terms of choosing the actions of what to do is a bit blurry, right? It's kind of foggy. What are the actions that the people need to do?
Oh, yeah. Well, coming together itself is an action. When you meet face to face, sure, discussion on something real is the first step. But then you say, okay, Native people do this routinely, people affiliated with us, especially in Western Canada. They don't talk at all. They just go in and they go into the Catholic church and they tell the priest to get out and they take over the building. They've done that a few times. They open it as daycare. They open up to the homeless, and there are a lot of them in the Native world. They say, come in and use the church now. What are they going to do? The Mounties show up and they say, hey, this is our land. You never signed a treaty with us. Bugger off. The Mounties always do. Because they know it's politically incorrect to attack Native people these days, right? You can use that as a lever, right? But so Native people do that because they've got nothing to lose. It's, we've talked about this before. The homeless Natives who occupied the churches with me, they were almost all homeless. I mean, they didn't have anything to lose and they knew it. But that's not the case with you know, so-called white people. And people who are locked into the system, you know, to take an action like that is almost inconceivable for most of them. And you can only break the ice by getting people to the point to realize you have to, because they're going to come to your door next, right? Despite the latest kind of, they're pulling back. Apparently they're saying that Biden the other day said, oh, the pandemic is over, and they're opening up the border with Canada again. But the point is, that's a pause in the whole war. It's going to get even worse. And people realize the only way to fight it is action, defending yourselves, eventually in arms. I mean, it comes down to a civil war, which is what we're in, right?
So are you expecting there to be – that we're in a pause period at the moment, and that they're brewing an assault, an attack?
I think – definitely in a place like Canada, where it's the battleground. North America now is the battleground geopolitically between the China-Vatican alliance and the West. And because two reasons, all the resources and the need to knock out America. Because, you know, Russia and China are the rising powers. China over Russia, of course, but America is declining. As a matter of fact, now America is very much in the position Great Britain was after World War II, just going down the toilet economically. America had half of the world's gross domestic product in the 1970s. They've got 12% now. I mean, as a matter of fact, the economy of Mexico and the Philippines has a higher GDP than America, if you can believe it. Right. I mean, so there's a big flip. The third world now is becoming the dominant force in America's. So the best way to destroy America is to do exactly what they're doing. You fund the Democrats and Republicans to rip each other apart. Right. And you turn on the news and that's what's going on. Republicans are now saying, let's kill Democrats, every man, woman and child. The Democrats are saying, let's lock up all the Republicans. That's perfect from Beijing's point of view, because they'll step in and pick up the pieces. And that's happening. The you know, we're seeing that the Chinese troops are already in British Columbia, and they're expanding down the West Coast of America as well. Joint military maneuvers. You know, I mean, it's happening as we speak. So, I mean, this, we're in a battleground over here. Maybe you're not in as immediately in some other places, but it's real. I mean, it's how it's playing out, right?
And there you have that classic divide and rule, right? They've got their media channels. They're using the Democrats and the Republicans, or, you know, they can use the blacks versus the whites, or they can use, you know, the Christians against the Protestants, or whatever it is. And this same cycle of self destruction of the public is instilled via the media channels of the day, right? And there's a very interesting list I saw about the Federal Reserve currency. Whichever nation is holding that Federal Reserve currency becomes the leading powerhouse in terms of the empirical hub and central point. So, you know, it moves, right? You can plot with a historian called Webster Tarpley how this cancer has gone, you know, from all the millennia, from Sumeria and Babylon all the way up to where we are with this one, you know, USA changing over across the Pacific to China. But it's so global now, and there's so much passive rebellion. Maybe that's an interesting way to say it. You know, just over here locally, we've got homeschool circles. People are rejecting the education system. We've got food gardens. People are rejecting the truckitarian supermarket culture. Common law assemblies seem to be very much on the rise wherever you look around the world these days. So, you know, is this transition going to work? Is, you know, with the injection, genocide, cull, whatever you want to call that, everybody's alive and awake to what's going on with the details of that. When I say everybody, a large percentage in comparison to, you know, what they expected with it, I'm sure.
Yeah, you've definitely seen that shift happening. Here's the thing, though. I find that when people take the example of the common law assemblies, when they form them, the spirit is very much what each person is thinking. What do I need to do to protect myself? Not what do we need to do as a group to create something different? That's never on the agenda. It's always about I need to protect myself. As soon as they're able to, they because that's all they were there for. And so it's building on sand. You have to ask, on what basis are you appealing to people? You got to give them a vision beyond themselves, because if you don't, I mean, you know, it's like I had a perfect example of that in Southern Ontario. There was a group called the Community Support Alliance, and they were doing all the things you were saying. It was fantastic. They were building homeschooling. They got farmers together. They were doing food exchange networks. Great. And I went to one of their meetings and I said, look, that's good in a defensive sense, what you're doing, but you've got to have a new framework, a whole umbrella of a sovereign republic to operate within. Otherwise, you're de facto in their jurisdiction and they have authority over you, right? And you know, you could see the whole thing shift. People went, wait a minute, you mean we have to replace the system? Well, won't that put us in danger? And boom, they all fell away, every single one of them. And they were all supportive. They were on board until we mentioned that. And then, you mean I have to look outside my little box? No, I don't want to do that. I want to secure my own position. So if you're operating out of that self-interested motive, it doesn't last. It's trying to hold water in your hands. It just slips away all the time. So that's been our challenge, to get people to evolve. And the only people are willing to evolve is when you have to. You know, doing something for a good intention means you can leave it at any point. You can abandon that because you have options. But when you don't have options and your life depends on it, you have to fight back to the end. That's what Sun Tzu says in The Art of War. Never back your enemy into a corner. Then they have to fight to the death. That's what they're doing with us. They're backing us into a corner, but then we're all trying to find an easy way out. And there is no easy way out. It's got to be collective. It's got to be action-based. And we've got to look beyond our own little parochial situation, right?
And so you see this, you know, the economic squeeze is on. You see it with the fuel prices. You see it with the supermarkets and the food. And people are, you know, feeling the pinch, feeling the squeeze in, as individuals. And because they're communicating with each other, they're seeing that, you know, it's a large number of people who are similarly in the same boat. But are they still not gelling? Well, it's an insecurity thing. Look after number one, you know, look after yourself and not rock the boat. Don't, you know, again, we've talked about this a few times before. You know, it's the classroom in the school psychology mentality where, you know, you don't have the stature, the self-worth, the self-esteem to contest what the teacher says, right? We're just too little.
Yeah, we don't believe in ourselves because we're being raised in a corporatized, atomized culture where you don't trust anyone. You just take care of yourself. and keep all the slaves divided and fighting each other. I mean, you know, they don't need to repress that much because we do it to ourselves. It's a self-replicating slavery, right? But here's an example. I remember working in Vancouver, you see this, the contrast. There's a thing called Main Street. And on the west side is the affluence, on the east side are the poor people and the Indians and the workers and all, you know, the hoi polloi, right? So standing on Main Street, you go over to the downtown section and you look at everyone and they're all walking around like this and then don't look at each other and they look afraid of each other, okay? Kind of like middle-class bourgeois culture. Then you cross over Main Street and you're in Aboriginal country, street Indians, and you see everyone walking around sharing everything. They just automatically share. A stranger comes by, hands them a smoke. They're interacting. They're looking at each other. It's kind of like when you go to countries. I remember one of the first times I went to Greece, I was in a rural village and everyone's just looking at each other. They'll look at you for 10 or 20 seconds. And it makes you kind of nervous because they're looking at you, right? And there's that contact, that human contact. You see that among, in this case, indigenous and really poor people. They have to depend on each other because what else do they have? They don't even get welfare checks. Their survival depends on each other. It's like when I was in Mayan communities in Mexico and Guatemala, same deal. Their life dependent on your neighbor. Therefore, you got to take each other seriously and fight to the death for each other, right? When you've got options, when you've got alternatives and you're doing okay, you know, and even the poorest person in our culture is totally affluent in comparison to native people anywhere, or, you know, targeted people, right? If you don't have those options, it comes down to us. So I think things are going to have to get really a lot worse so that we're all suffering like that, and then we'll learn to fight. But in the meantime, nobody's fighting that I can see, really, in a significant way, except, you know, kind of on the margins here and there, like the native folks I mentioned who just seize buildings and, you know, do the occupations. We had in our church occupations, there was on average 50 to 60 natives and 2 to 3 white people. I was usually the only white guy there. Whites were terrified of doing church occupations. They still are. You know, it's funny.
My situation is makes it really stark what you're talking about here. You know, I've lived in England and London particularly, and you know that's much more wealthy than Wales and Southwest Ireland, and I completely agree with what you're saying that you're in a city in London, 6, 8, 10 million people, however many it is. And, you know, it's a very lonely place because nobody's interacting, or very little communication, even if you're on a packed underground train. But then, you know, you go to Wales and the affluence drops, but the community spirit increases. And then, you know, even more so over here in Ireland, where I'm now, I've noticed a stark increase in that community spirit. And you look at how history has evolved, and you know the cancer empire, if you like, has gone from London west to where we are now, and then it's hopped the Atlantic over to where you are. And the most action, you know, we used that word a little earlier on, is with the indigenous people who have that indigenous spirit. You know, perhaps is a way of describing it, to get active and, you know, occupy churches or whatever the actions are, much more so than people in London. And then you can regress that even further back through Europe, you know, to Rome or whatever it is.
Yeah.
But again, there's this springboard, this knee-jerk reaction to the economic situation, to the food situation, to the health assault. You know, many more people are beginning to see through the bullshit of the COVID situation, and there is that groundswell that, in inverted commas, something has to be done. It's just that people don't really know what that something is.
Yeah, it's like my dad. That story. My dad was in the Korean War, and when the first time he was under fire over in Korea, his whole regiment got wiped out. He was one of the few survivors. These were young boys. He was an infantry replacement unit. And they came in and I don't know how he survived, but they got totally overrun by the Chinese. And it was just a slaughter, he said. But when he was first under fire, the new recruits, they all ducked down because they think they can fight without risking anything. Their first concern is to protect themselves. And then your buddy next door gets his face blown off, and then you realize, and they're coming over, you've got to fight. And suddenly you forget your own need to protect yourself, and you're caught up in the battle. And when you overcome that hurdle of having to protect yourself and doing everything to protect yourself and just attack, then you become a warrior, right? And or in this case, a soldier, right? So, I mean, we're still in the point of being raw recruits trying to avoid the bullets, right?
Yeah.
And you need the veterans to say, come on, guys, go and lead by example. And that's why so many veterans always die first. And the officers and the veterans tend to get killed first because they're leading. They have to lead by example. And hopefully others will learn under fire. But that's the point. We're not under fire. Not enough of us are under fire. And that's where you learn all the lessons, not by talking, but by the experience of being under fire, right?
Well, it's a really interesting point because we are under fire. I just saw some stats this morning. Max Egan's latest video was really interesting about, you know, you mentioned wars in Southeast Asia. In 2021, between the ages of 20 and 45, 60,000 people died because of these injections, right? Which is right. The same number of Americans that died in the Vietnam War, right? But because of this clandestine narrative that's covering what's actually going on, people, you know, have question marks. Oh, maybe it is, you know, an act of nature, and you know, Mother Nature's killing us, not Big Brother or whatever it is. But as these stats increasingly become mainstream and understood and realized, and you know, everybody's got someone in their community or in their backyard that has had myocarditis or, you know, a stroke or whatever it is because of these injections, the penny drops and the realization arrives that we are being strategic, smart weapons are killing people, and our own tax purse is paying for it via these people at the top who we have been led to believe are, you know, our representatives and care about our health or whatever. So, you know, it's that sort of creaking cogs waking people up to the inversion aspect. It's such a massive jump. We've been here before, yeah. You know, between thinking that, you know, King Charles III is a nice family guy because the BBC tell us so, as opposed to being, you know, the head kingpin of a massive genocidal global criminal organization. Transnational.
That's not what I meant by being under fire. Okay, yes, we're being medically killed. Yes, we're being killed by toxins, but we have a home to go to. We have medical alternatives, naturopaths. You know, that's not being under fire. You're still holding on to stuff. I mean, being thrown in prison for months, okay? You've experienced it, right, for weeks. You've been targeted. You know what it's like. You know what the terror is like of realizing the whole weight of the state is coming down on you. It's seeing friends getting killed. It's being blackballed so that you can't even appear in public and give a talk without being assaulted, right? And I mean, it's moving that way, and it's good. More people need to go through that. What you and I have been through, and other people, and your friends killed, and you know, then you wake up to the real need to fight, because people aren't fighting now. You know, like you say, they're talking and they're maneuvering to avoid getting hurt. It's a defensive response. So, I mean, this is one of the phases. We're just in the early phase, so we've got to lose a lot more before we can really take action, you know.
And then the perception is that, you know, the individual is just one against the weight of the state. And if you're swinging punches, you're likely to get punches swung back at you, right? And so the question then becomes, maybe if I don't swing any punches, then I won't get punches swung back at me. And then people, you know, anesthetize themselves with alcohol and stuff, right?
Right. But I mean, I don't really care. I mean, I had a meeting, you know, one of our Republic Alliance meetings where we're meeting people in different countries every Saturday on our calls. You know, it's like I said to them, you can't be diluted by the people around you. You've got to retain your salt, like they say in the Bible, right? Don't lose your saltiness. And we always do that. We always play down to other people to try to bring them in. But we're just lowering our own energy level to that defensive thing you're talking about, that fear-based response. What do I need to avoid getting hurt? To hell with it. Stop worrying about getting hurt. start being concerned about who's getting hurt if you don't take action. I don't care about these people. You know, you face your average cop and everything. Are they a threat? I mean, didn't we all create this situation? There's no enemy out there. We are a collective problem here. And the only way we're going to get out of this is to face ourselves honestly and say, okay, I'm through. I'm done. We've got to create something different. And it's an imperative if we're going to survive. So again, it's kind of waiting for that enough people to suffer to reach that point. And again, I don't really see it right now, but it's something that's definitely in the works. It's got to happen, right?
Right. It's a process, you know, because again, mentioned the media channels, because it's very difficult for people to communicate except in person, you know, hand to hand around the town, or mouth to mouth around the town, or whatever it is, one person at a time, right? You know, have you heard about Dave down the road who dropped dead with myocarditis? Shit, there's another one. You know, another question mark. The camel's back. You know, collects the strands of straw, and eventually, you know, an individual camel collapses, and they're in the fight, right? They're like you're saying.
Yeah, but here's the thing: like, people fight, and when you look at when revolutions happen, it gets to the two things need to happen. The old system breaks down and can't operate anymore. And enough people say we can't operate in this old system. But then they do a brief little shift and they're looking for a way to get back to everything they knew. People tend to make revolutions with their eyes on the past. How do I get back to that point of security instead of thinking, well, how do we create something new? And that's very hard for human being, the human psyche, to even imagine something new, because we're all people of routine. You know, we're biologically equipped that way. But here's something, I know we've only got about 6 minutes left here, but I want to just say that I saw a really interesting thing on a documentary, I remember years ago, and it was talking about these coronal ejections out of the sun, sunbursts. Do you know that in 2012, in March, we came within 9 days of having the whole planet incinerated? That maybe this was the 2012 prediction, I don't know, but there was a sunburst that came 9 days after we had crossed that point in the orbit where it shot. Okay, when that happens, even if it's a mild one, every electrical system on the planet is now gone and everyone dies, because not only is there no electricity to preserve food and operate anything, right? Planes all crash. The nuclear reactors all melt down. Over 1,000 nuclear reactors spew constant radiation all over the planet. So all we need, and these sunbursts happen routinely every few centuries, there's a death sentence hanging over us. The next time there's a sunburst that hits planet Earth, we're all dead, as is probably most of the life on the planet. So knowing that, the question is, we know that. Scientists, we're not stupid. We know these things. How come we're not shutting down reactors, creating alternatives outside the electricity-based system like solar power? Why aren't we doing that? Well, the reason we're not doing it is because there's a death wish. There's a suicidal impulse operating, and it's stronger the higher you go up in society. It's absolute at the higher levels, and it percolates down. We're all doing it. We're all in the psychosis where we're automatically doing things to destroy ourselves. And when you recognize that, to say, well, I'm part of a mass psychosis of death here, and are we going to survive it? Likely we're not going to survive that. Just look at the scientific facts. You know, next sunburst, we're all dead, but we seem to want that. So anyway, that's an interesting insight to this, kind of the bigger picture here, right?
Well, it's a self-sacrificial attitude, headset that comes, yeah. I think, you know, perhaps through the childhood thing where the worth of the child is very much dependent on what they do, as opposed to, you know, their being themselves, how they are, right? And so, you know, people get into this, you know, strive 9 to 5, 9 to 6, 9 to 8 PM or whatever it is, you know, burn themselves out, smash themselves physically, because they need to project, there's an interesting word, an idea of worth through, you know, conventional channels and means to impress parents that, you know, are even dead sometimes, because that's what the values were instilled over many multi-generations over a long period of time, through, you know, hereditary lines, right? And you know, this is the whole clearing aspect that's coming. And, you know, you can get into the great year and the end of the age of Pisces, which has a self-sacrificial characteristic to it. But we're moving into this time now where things seem to be transitional, up for grabs. There seems to be a real awareness arrival of looking at things different, just from a health perspective, right? You know, people are thinking to themselves, well, maybe I'm not going to take those antidepressant tablets because it's just a pharmaceutical chemical. And, you know, everybody's got question marks about the corporations now. So maybe I should, you know, do something
but they're not,
a little different.
Okay, but again, they're not breaking from the psychosis of death. I mean, and you know, I think of that quote, they have eyes but do not see, ears but do not hear. And it's deliberate. It's not like they're just ignorant. It's like we want to be that way. We would rather be comfortable than alive. And so that means we're heading towards death. Now, I mean, we all are as individuals anyway, right? It's a matter of facing that death and saying how are we going to live before then, how are we going to die. And so I just think we need to step back a bit from all of the apparent issues and say, look at as a collective, who are we as humanity? What are we creating? Where are we heading? And the prospect is not good, but that's okay. Like, it's just probably our turn to pass on, right? But we can't, there are no parameters. I think my main point is there are no parameters. There's no measurements within the system whereby we can look at any of this, because it's all based on a huge illusion of this cult of death, which we play out. Look at history. Look at our genocidal history.
Right. It is a death cult. It is a death cult. And the parameters you talk about are very much connected with leadership, right? And if the leadership are sacrificing the public as part of cult rituals, then, you know, that's something that needs addressing, right? Hey, we've got 2 minutes left on this call, Kev. Shall we stop it and start again for 10 minutes?
Sure.
Let's talk about leadership. So let's just go straight back into it. So you're talking about the parameters of society that people are caught in terms of the rat race and the wheel. I was asking you a question regarding that in connection with leadership. So with leadership, I would posit it, we require leadership, at least for a transitional period, before people can develop away from codependence to independence and hopefully eventually interdependence, you know, the land of milk and honey, anarchy, whatever you want to call it, whereby we don't need an authoritarian, overlording, you know, teacher of the classroom, if you like, to look after the people. But until that maturity, that self-actualization, that rising awareness becomes wholesale and widespread, I would suggest that the parameters of society need to have some kind of leadership to facilitate it.
Taking people on about their assumption that politicians are evil, he said, no, they're just us. We get who we elect who we are, right? If they're mediocre and self-serving criminal, well, who put them in power, people? What culture raised them? You know, it's like we have to take responsibility. Nothing's ever done to us. The leadership reflects who we are, right? And even the notion of leadership, it's when you look, it's interesting that the first thing I studied at university was anthropology, because I was always fascinated in this question of how did it come about that humanity created a state and kings and churches and, you know, religious rulers? How did that even come about? Because it doesn't make any sense if you're just tilling the earth. Why would you think that somebody had to rule over you? Why would you have to hand your crops over to somebody else and go fight in his army, right? That came about because when you started living in communities, you suddenly had surpluses of food, okay? So you then had the ability for a few people to say, well, that's mine now, right? And that private monopoly over what was a gift given by all, given to all, by, you have to somehow convince people that's necessary. How do you do it? Religion. Hey, guess what, folks? These few people over here who are claiming all the food, they're actually descended from the gods. You know that thunder in the sky? They're his children. They were appointed, so they're closer to heaven than you are, which is what the Pope still says. You know, Pontifex Maximus, he's the link between heaven and earth. So it's an iceberg. One of them found top, six sevenths beneath the surface. And that's the laboring mass of humanity. We serve these elites, right? because we think they're better than us. And besides, what's the alternative? It's set up for a few to rule the many. That's leadership. Leadership is somebody telling you what they can do. But there's the internal leadership, which says, no, foreign sovereign. Nobody can tell me what to do. That's the indigenous way of looking at it. Nobody can tell another what to do. I mean, where do they gather that authority from? If you have a gun to your head, you're with us, don't you? That's not freedom. It's been coerced into, you know, you're going to get arrested if you go against this that everyone's afraid of. So when you say leadership, you got to be saying, well, what kind of leadership and who's it serving, right? That's kind of my general take on it.
Right? Yeah, I would completely agree that there's that, you know, corporatization of the spiritual aspect of life, where they have said, you know, put your money in the collection dish. We've got to keep the roof over the church. And, you know, in order for God to be pleased with you and, you know, for the rains to come every season to grow the crops, you got to pay. Sure, there's definitely that. But I would also suggest that similarly, there's the false flag idea, where a bogeyman enemy is created. So the people's resonant energy is fear. And so, you know, go back into history and the village is afraid because the Viking raiding ship might be coming. So in order to protect us from the terrorism, is to keep it a general phrase, we've got to pay for the knights or pay for the weapons or pay for the castles in order to protect ourselves. And that then requires an aspect of leadership that needs to be separate from the tilling of the land and the creation of the general sustenance, because of the fear factor that is instilled
right
deliberately.
Well, think about all those soldiers right now. This is just the latest war, right? But I mean, think of the Russian soldiers and the Ukrainian soldiers. Why are they killing each other? You know, I remember my good friend Ellen Murphy. She was arrested for running out a flyer at a U.S. Army recruitment office in Bellingham, Washington, and all it said was, why kill strangers? Because strangers tell you to. And that's the basic issue. Why should I go kill a stranger, right? Well, you're convinced that there's somehow a threat to you. Like you said, you create the external threat. And now, you know, they're condemning Russia and the Security Council for crimes against humanity, right? The perpetrators of crimes against humanity are accusing other genocidal killers of genocide. Okay, so the point is, how do you get the masses of people to do what's against their best interest, and which doesn't come naturally? We don't naturally kill and hate each other. Quite the opposite. We're like Marcus Aurelius said in his Meditations. He said, we are born for cooperation. Human beings are like teeth in a body, and like hands, we're built to cooperate together. That's how we are naturally. The cooperative principle is the law of nature. So how do we subvert that and get everyone to hate and fear each other? Well, we've talked about a lot of those methods, but it's also when you're cut off from the land, when you're cut off from your natural relationship to Mother Earth. When you see, I was out the other day in the countryside, and I was just stopped by asking for directions. And this farming family, they were so open. They offered me a meal. It's like when you're close to the earth, you're not threatened by anybody. You're in that natural harmony, right? And you probably see that over in Ireland. People are like that quite often.
It's phenomenal. I stopped for directions a few days ago, and I was there for an hour having tea and cakes. You know, people are just so friendly. You know, but what the awareness is coming around to, and you know, it's you can get a bit frustrated by the speed with which it's happening, but it seems to be, you know, increasingly happening, is that the. Whether it's COVID, whether it's Putin, whether it's Bin Laden or Saddam Hussein or whoever the bogeyman is instilled into the psyche and the perception by the media channels. And they are controlled by, you know, those people at the top of the pile. And you're right. I don't contest for a second what you're saying, that because of our own, you know, lack of effort or apathy or whatever the reasons are, we are, you know, meeting the reflection and the representation of ourselves with our leadership. But our leadership are self-destructive, right, to humanity. And that understanding, that awareness that we're fueling our own downfall and destruction to, you know, help the, we started this conversation, we'll perhaps finish the same conversation with the phrase parasites or vampires, you know, that are sucking our blood from us, and we're, you know, fueling them with which to do so. And yeah, you say she's just an individual, but it's the latest, whether it's Charles or Biden or whoever it is, it's a carousel that needs addressing. You know, that's such a general way to say it, needs halting, right? Stopping.
Well, and you pull that out, you pull your energy out of it and think in a different way and act in a different way, and it starts. And that's the biggest threat. That's what the machine. And again, I love that example of how we don't talk about individuals or even a system. You talk about the spirit behind it. Like when I did that exorcism in Rome, I addressed the spirit of Rome. I didn't talk about the Pope. I didn't talk about the Vatican. I talked about the entity behind it. You know, there's different versions of what that is. Some think it's an external force that's kind of taken over humanity. Others, Jung talked about the collective unconscious. We create this higher entity just from our own thoughts and interactions. There's this higher thing that we all belong to, right? The group mind, the hegemonicon, Marcus Aurelius called it. That
legion, right?
You've got to address the group. Right. Okay. So you address it. And that's in that exorcism. I addressed that group mind. I said, your time's over. Step forward. And sure enough, that conjuncture sparked something in the world that's led to a lot of this stuff, you know, not just the resignation of Ratzinger and that, all of this stuff coming out, because we address the thing, the group mind. And that's what we all have to do. We have to, in our own meditations and actions, say, speak to the group mind that we're part of. We're a cell in it. And we say, I'm out. Your time is over. I'm not a part of you anymore. Enough people do that, and it'll start crumbling even more dramatically, because we're all energetically connected. No man is an island, John Donne, right? I mean, we have to take responsibility for withdrawing from that at every moment. And it gets easier the more you do it. But it's hard initially to do it because we're so wedded to it. We belong to it. And it's a possession, right? And that's the thing to realize, right?
Truth is so uncomfortable, right? You know, comfortable lies or uncomfortable truths. And the more fervent people can get for truth, you know, the more the hegemonicon or the demon of legion, that energetic that holds it all together, collapses and crumbles. But you know, truth is inverted, right? We're presented with lies deliberately to keep us asleep and anesthetized, and turning 180 degrees and focusing on hard, gnarly, gritty, complicated and gritty truths is the big requirement of our generation.
We all avoid it. I mean, you know, the old saying, anyone can see through a lie unless they have need of the lie. And that's the point. We all have the need of the lie so we can keep onto our illusion of comfort and security, that we're never going to die, we're going to be fine, we're not going to suffer pain. Not realizing that pain is the indication that you're alive. That's why, like a lot of survivors of the death camps in Canada, the Christian death camps, remember Delmar Johnny, my Cowichan friend, said, when I was a young guy, I kept slashing myself with razors. And I said, like, why? He said, well, I had to remind myself I was alive because the pain told me I was alive. I said, well, why did I have to be reminded? Well, to survive these monsters raping and torturing me and killing kids around me every day, I had to withdraw. Boom. I withdrew into my own little world, and I didn't know if I was alive anymore or not, right? It's like a classic dissociation of psychosis, right? So we need the pain, not self-inflicted, but the pain of reality to get us back into what's real, because we're all anesthetized and in a dissociated life because of all of this horrible trauma, right?
Yeah, certainly. Yeah. Disassociation, and we're back to mind control, right? Because that's what's done with these divisions, with these alter egos, you know, the roles we play, whether, you know, we go to work and present ourselves as a good employee, or we go back home and we present ourselves as a good husband or wife or father or whatever it is, you know, getting down to that truthful essence of what the human is, the individual is themselves. And then, you know, as opposed to, or back to the hegemonicon, the demon of legion, right? The groupthink, the herd mentality. It's the big,
the best moment, the most liberating moments I've found with individuals are when they're on their deathbeds. And Native people easily, I think in one of my books I described this, there were two incidents in West Coast General Hospital in Port Alberni. I was with a Native family whose elder would die, and then I was with a white family who the mother was dying of liver cancer. And the Natives were gathered around this guy. They were all wailing. Little kids, they even brought in the dogs. The whole family, the whole extended family were there surrounding him as he was dying. And they were crying and they were hugging him and they were showing all this emotion. It's like in an Irish wake, right? It goes on for 3 days. Everyone's just mourning and laughing and remembering the guy. It's like this incredible chance to just say goodbye, but also to value the beauty and the sacredness of every moment of life, every breath, right? And I went from that, and then down the hall, this woman, Carol, was dying of liver cancer. She was only in her 30s. And they were all standing there, really rigid and frightened. And the brother is saying, "Don't worry, sis, you'll be up and around next week," right? And she's in her terminal phase. Her skin was all yellow. She was going. So I finally had to say to them, "It's time to say goodbye. Say your goodbyes." And they turned on me with such vehemence and anger. Said, "You know, how dare you? How dare you say that to her?" And I said, "No, it's the truth. Look at her," right? And they eventually broke down, and they did. They went through the same thing the Native people went through. But it took that. And in a way, I see that's still my role. I'm saying to the whole culture, look, we're dying. It's our last days. Maybe something will come out of it. Maybe not. Who knows? But I've got to face it, people. And after that, they never talked to me again. They quit my church. They saw me on the street. They wouldn't look at me because I was that ugly reminder of what they were in, you know, that dissociated denial of the death we were in. And to me, I always remember that because it's only when you can face that when you have that indigenous sense of the beauty and the mystery of every moment of life and how death is part of that. It's that beautiful transition to who knows what, but you know, you see that in the deathbed. So we're in a deathbed moment. We're in a death very much. The exorcism didn't work. We're in the deathbed phase, right?
Yeah. You were the scapegoat, right? You were the messenger to be shot, right? Because you were the harbinger of truth that they didn't like.
That's why they still hate me. You had to, brother. You had to, that's why the smear campaign. That's what the hate Kavanaugh campaign is exactly what we're talking about.
Right. Pack it all up. Pack all the shit up and put it on someone's shoulders, and then you know. Sacrifice them. Sacrifice is, you know, you can get right back to the ancient tribal cultures, right? You know, because of the harvest has failed, you put it into a goat and you create the scapegoat, right? You sacrifice the goat, and those energies of emotion, powerful limbic system emotions, are to be honored and respected. You know, you think about it from a scientific, energetic, electromagnetics perspective. You know, the oscillation is what creates the power, right? So if you're cutting yourself off from a big movement of emotions, you know, we've even got a phrase for it to label people as mentally ill these days, right? We call it bipolar, right? If people are moving their emotions from one place to another, we say that they're mentally ill with it, right? But in fact, that's oscillation is what creates the power, right? It's so healthy to to have the capacity.
That's interesting. It's interesting the system would call people bipolar because then that's this massive projection because that's we live in a completely bipolar culture. I think that when you see in America, they like to fly the American flag and the Confederate flag side by side as if the Civil War is still going on. Well, it is still going on because you've got those two thrusts in America, one towards liberty and the other towards slavery. And the great book to read, Democracy in America by de Tocqueville, he was a French aristocrat who came over and studied America in the 1830s. And he said, Americans have this two impulses. And this can be said about everybody in the world. One is they want to be self-governing. But by doing that, they're so concerned about themselves, they surrender responsibility for public affairs to a few people. So America have within it both liberty and tyranny side by side all the time. Because to have the self-focused life, you need a few people running things. And that's the big contradiction in all the talk of freedom in that is that, okay, but what about responsibility? What about like we talked about at the beginning, it's not about my rights. It's about responsibility for everybody, taking care of each other as well, right? That's where left and right can come together because right's all, it's like right wing is right brain. It's all, you know, impulse. Left wing is left brain. It's rational. you know, the cooperative impulse of the of left wing politics with the individual right impulse of right wing. Why doesn't it just come together? Why don't we overcome that political bipolarism and find that unity? So, I mean, all of this is personal, the political, psychological, but it's all in the terminal phase. And this is gives us a chance to look at it all because it's ending. Right.
Yeah. And you can get, you know, electromagnetic scientific about it. When those poles of the magnet spin in harmony faster and faster and faster, then it creates that one up and down pulse because of the spin, right? Which is a very healthy conclusion to it all. The centrifugal, you know, the black and white, if you like, creates that singularity of shade, right?
Right. Right.
Still science.
Oh, this is good. Good stuff.
Yeah. Okie dokie. We hit the hour, Kev. Let's call it a day, shall we?
Okay.
Chat to you.
Thanks,
on.
Thanks, I look forward to it.
Yeah, see you on the weekend.
Yeah, I look forward to talking to you on Saturday on the call and hearing this on your broadcast. I'm going to play this on the air too, so thank you.
Okie dokie. Yep, nice one. See you on the weekend. Okay. See you Saturday.